Marshawn Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
And I think you can actually go further back to things he wrote, you know, in the late 2000s, where he's talking about anxiety over globalization. He was, you know, very much aware of this kind of resurgence of skepticism towards immigration, and was doing, was sort of playing a role in that, but saw it coming for sure. And I think in general, kind of he's inclined to a pessimistic take, I would argue. And of course, that can be a source of insight and power, especially in an industry that kind of tends, as he's written, right, to these kind of rosy, you know, and sort of vague ideas about the future.
Hey, everybody. Happy Tuesday. We are continuing our really great series of episodes. A bunch of people wrote in asking to have this conversation with Max Chafkin. He is the author of the new biography of Peter Thiel, The Contrarian. Because it's The Realignment, had absolutely zero interest in the personal details or the scandals. Really, we were more interested in the actual ideas itself. Sagar, you couldn't make this interview, but we talked a bit about what was so interesting about discussing Peter's ideas and how they actually play into all these debates.
Yeah, I'm sorry I've been gone, guys. I've been having a ton of travel, which has made scheduling really difficult with all of Breaking Points. But I was really sad to miss this one because I actually listened to about half of it so far on Audible. And one of the things that Max actually does nail is that the ideas of Peter Thiel, monopolization, wanting to be Google if you're in that business, wanting and looking forward to the markets and how to scale. Actually, Peter Thiel is one of the most influential thinkers in all of Silicon Valley, and he's had his fingers in some of the biggest deals, not to mention just his cultural footprint relative to what exactly the man has done. So that's what I think you guys are going to get the most out of this conversation, the ideas. What exactly influences this pretty idiosyncratic man who has a history at Stanford, a libertarian, now has become a nationalist, and how he's just imprinted himself on the U.S. economy? I think that's the big story of Peter Thiel.
And look, my big whole thing here is, and this is what I will always say to people, my big frustration with the coverage of the book and Peter in general the past few weeks has been it hasn't focused on the ideas end, and it's basically treated him as just one of many eccentric billionaires. But Sagar, you and I both had this experience after 2016 where we read George Packer, who we just had on the show, his book, The Unwinding, an inner history of a new America. And it actually quotes Peter around 2011, 2012 as saying, essentially, you know, the conventional wisdom that the way to succeed in American politics is through hope and optimism and Ronald Reagan 1980 sunny stuff, that's just wrong. When I read that in 2017, after Trump became president, I was like, oh my God. Like, actually, if you'd lived your life, if you'd looked at politics through that lens, all of the crazy stuff that happened in the 2010s, not just at home, but abroad, would have made sense. Yeah. And that is the part which isn't focused enough in these actual concepts, which is that, think about it this way. If you had read Thomas Friedman or you'd imbibed the thought of Peter Thiel, which was a better diagnosis of post-1990s America? That doesn't mean you have to agree with the conclusions. It doesn't mean you have to agree with the policies. It doesn't mean you have to agree with any individual actions that Peter has taken. But what I want people to really get in this episode is, how should they think about the world, and how can being contrarian at a certain point actually serve you?
100%.
A lot of great stuff here. Quick shout outs. This, of course, is a book. It's available in our bookshop. You can check out our Substack, where I'll put out a quick little essay on the interview and this topic. And of course, you can check out all the other great work we're doing. Let's get into the episode. Max Chafkin, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. You've done an excellent job of doing a lot of podcast appearances, a lot of different places. So I want to take this in a slightly different angle.
Great.
So Sebastian Mallaby, in his review of your book in The Atlantic, said this really useful thing when he pointed out that when you're doing a biography, half of what you're trying to do is capture the person you're doing a biography of, and the other part of what you're trying to do is capture the times that they are living in. So to anyone who's looking for a really comprehensive story of Peter Thiel, I recommend that you purchase the book. That's covered really well. And what I want to focus more on today are the ideas and the times that this story that Max is telling is operating in. So let's just start here. Let's talk about contrarianism as a concept, because the thing I kept coming back to during the book was this idea of, you know what, if you actually look back at everything Peter is doing, from his decision to leave the tracked post-law school path to the investments he made to his initial prognostications on the political system in the late 1990s, early 2000s, diagnosis-wise, it seems totally correct to me. It seems that being a contrarian was the proper way to look at this. I mean, how do you think about that part?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, let me, I'll say a couple of things. I think being a contrarian is sort of always, it's valuable as an investor, right? And that's kind of like what, at its core, Peter Thiel is a public intellectual, somebody who's, I think, increasingly like a political actor, but he's, at his core, I'm an investor. And I think that, and in particular, a venture capitalist. And, you know, of course, venture capital is all about these kind of making these long shot bets where that are very unlikely to pay off. But if they do, it's going to be worth a huge amount of money. And I think in that sense, you know, that ideology, it's not, I mean, I don't know if calling it an ideology is quite right, but that, that kind of frame of thinking is super useful if you're making these kind of long shot bets. And I also think, and I think this is kind of what you're hinting at, you know, and it's what drew me to the book. Silicon Valley and the tech industry has gone over the last 25 years, over the course of Thiel's career, has gone from being, you know, of course, economically and culturally important, but not the most important thing economically or culturally. And in this time, it's gone from being kind of this sideshow to being, I'd say, front and center, to being, I would argue the most important economic, I think that is undisputed, the most important economic center in the world, and the most important, I would argue, cultural center, and maybe not quite yet, but I think it's on the ascent, you know, politically as well. And I think when you're kind of a revolutionary, when you're on the side and you're trying to push your way in, which is kind of, I think, both a framework that Peter Thiel and kind of his acolytes would accept and kind of embrace, this kind of like, you know, we're revolutionaries, we're gonna, you know, disrupt the status quo. Of course, that framework is super useful, and I think it can help explain, you know, the success of PayPal and Thiel's, large parts of his success going forward.
Yeah, I'd like you to speak about René Girard as a framing device for thinking about mimetic theory and how people come to hold the ideas they hold. Because what I was getting at with the question about contrarianism, and I've been revisiting this because everyone and their cousin is obviously thinking about the war in Afghanistan, 20 years of the war on terror. And I just don't have, or it's, I just have the instinct that if you look back at what the conventional wisdom was in either direction on basically most topics from the period of 1991 to 2007, it seems as if that conventional wisdom was incorrect. It seems as if we're talking beyond just the tech industry, taking what Thomas Friedman is saying about globalization, or taking people who are way too pro-market in 2007 as gospel, would have been the incorrect thing. So I'm just curious, like in the context of René Girard, how you think about that, and if you could explain his thought first.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the basic idea is that, you know, mimetic theory is that people are imitating each other. The things that they want are not things that they actually want. They're the things that other people want. And that you can use that to sort of explain, you know, as you said, you know, lots of things and behaviors in society. And of course, there's this, this idea of scapegoating where people sort of gang up on a single individual. I'm not sure. I think that... that idea is of course very, very powerful, and it can apply, you know, it has been applied to all sorts of dimensions, including, you know, business. I don't know that it totally explains Peter Thiel as an investor, even though he has kind of said that it's his, you know, sort of main, you know, one of the key, you know, sources for how he approaches, you know, investing in business. I think he's somebody who's been really successful selling into bubbles and selling. Now, of course, okay, that's the other side of the coin. Maybe that's accepting. Maybe that's like having this hyper awareness of the role that mimetic desire plays and sort of taking advantage of it. You know, when you sell into bubbles, which is definitely something he's done and done exceedingly successfully over his career. That's not necessarily a contrarian bet. It's maybe a contrarian method to a sort of conventional bet. Yeah, exactly. So, because like, you know, PayPal, of course, overcame the dot-com bust. But before it did that, it sold into the bubble. There were tons of payment companies out there. And Thiel was able to outlast them through, you know, a combination of, you know, really, really great management and this kind of culture that I think developed around the company. I think Palantir in a lot of ways is selling in initially, right? Is selling into a big idea. The big idea being, hey, we need better data mining and Thiel realizing that PayPal had developed this technology. Now I'm talking about 2002, 2003, post 9/11, when it was like very clear that the you know, that U.S. intelligence had missed things. So anyway, I think that is a case of also of kind of selling into a bubble. But I'm making the opposite point, and now as I say it out loud, I'm realizing, you know, that's just a case of an insight. And you know, you could draw it out to Facebook too, because there is this kind of weird tension, right? How does somebody who's a big fan of René Girard invest in Facebook? I mean, Facebook is, you know, it's like creating these mimetic dynamics that Girard talks about. On the other hand, it's, you know, maybe that's the central insight. Maybe that's the reason, and it probably is the reason why it's so powerful. Except, of course, that power is, as I think even Peter Thiel, even the guy who was the first investor in Facebook would agree, it's, you know, it can be kind of scary.
Yeah, and speaking of scary, I want to talk about optimism and pessimism within this framework, because something you capture well in the book is that there is so much tech press and there's narratives and everyone has their own narrative. And sometimes it's difficult to sort through and what to take seriously. But going back, one of my favorite books is The Unwinding by George Packer.
Yep.
He obviously did a long profile of Peter Thiel in The New Yorker in 2011 that we'll cite. But in that book, which came out in 2013, Peter is quoted as saying effectively, I think the notion that the American body politic is looking for optimism and Reaganite sunshine is incorrect. And I read that in 2017, right after Trump's election. And hearing that, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Peter is actually, that is, it's easy to give a Trump take after the Trump take, but that is a take where you could look at that in 2013 and extrapolate. So can you speak about the optimism, pessimism? And I'm not trying to just do like a Peter, like hagiography thing, because we could get into like the implications where things kind of go astray.
Sure.
But I think these are the central insights, which I think were very helpful. So yeah. Please talk about that.
Yeah. Okay. So I think Thiel, he gets into this whole framework in 0 to 1, this, you know, there's definite optimism, indefinite optimism, definite pessimism, indefinite pessimism. And I think he's in favor of, you know, being more definite rather than indefinite. And I think he leans pessimistic. When you go back and, I mean, not just that Packer profile, you're totally right. Amazing insight, right? And I think you can actually go further back to things he wrote, you know, in the late 2000s, where he's talking about anxiety over globalization. He was, you know, very much aware of this kind of resurgence of skepticism towards immigration and was doing, you know, was sort of playing a role in that, but saw it coming for sure. And I think in general, kind of he's inclined to a pessimistic take. I would argue, and of course that can be a source of insight and power, especially in an industry that kind of tends, as he's written, right, to these kind of rosy, you know, and sort of vague ideas about the future. Now, I do think it's always important with Thiel, and this, you know, we kind of talked about this a little bit in the last conversation. You know, I talked to a bunch of people who worked at his hedge fund, and the thing that they talked about was that he always has kind of a pessimistic portfolio and an optimistic portfolio. So in the 2000s, when he was, you know, predicting the collapse of the U.S. economy, correctly, I might say, predicting the collapse of the U.S. economy, and talking about, you know, how people were underrating the prospect of apocalypse. I mean, it's a really dark, really dark ideas and sort of scary notions about not just the future of the United States, but also maybe the future of, you know, the West or something. He's also, of course, betting on Facebook and betting on Palantir, defense contractor, big military contractor. Of course, those guys aren't going around telling, you know, the U.S. government, the generals that they're selling, that the U.S. is screwed. And so there is this tendency, I think, where he's got both, right? He's got bets that are optimistic, and bets that are pessimistic. And there's a way to kind of unify those together, right? Because, you know, nothing's going to operate, you know, by itself. There could be, it's true, the U.S. could totally, you know, have an economic collapse and Facebook would still, you know, grow, which is exactly what happened, of course. So I think there's this, I think he's able to kind of, but I think he's very pessimistic in general, just kind of like characterologically, if that's a word, but also super good at using those insights. I should say most of the time, because it hasn't always worked out.
I'm glad you brought up immigration, because it actually speaks to an intellectual frustration I had from reading the book. Because on the one end, you describe Peter in his support of Trump and the more MAGA section of the Republican Party as embodying nationalism. But on the other hand, if you look at the early articulation of PayPal and using this system that exists outside the state, if you look at the actual articulation of what people are saying around seasteading or charter cities, ironically, they are right-wing to libertarian hyper-globalist projects. I'm not going to name names here, but people who are particularly on Twitter know who I'm talking about here. There are certain people in the tech space who talk about how they don't like things that are woke and they just see all these like right-wing things. But if you actually look at the intellectual implications of them adopting the ideas of the sovereign individual and them pushing crypto and these things the way they push it, they are actually attacking the nation state at a level that your most globalist left-wing liberal person would never actually contemplate. So can you talk about that contradiction there?
I mean, there is a huge there, but I mean, you know, Thiel's full of contradictions. So yes, I absolutely agree. There's a contradiction between supporting Donald Trump and at times articulating this like extremely nationalistic view of the U.S. And also operating in an industry that is driven in large part by pushing, you know, those national boundaries aside. I mean, Silicon Valley, you know, and this includes, you know, the companies that Thiel has been involved with, maybe not PayPal, but you know, certainly more recently, you know, they are filled with immigrants. And Thiel himself, of course, is an immigrant. And they're not just filled with immigrants, but as you say, often premised on the idea of transcending nations. And I think the thing you brought up with PayPal, this idea of kind of busting up the nation state, which like he talked about, it's not that wasn't like a subtle implication of PayPal. That was out front and center. That was what was part of the sell. And I think, you know, everyone kind of missed that because, you know, obviously like it's, you want to like buy stuff on eBay and PayPal was like legitimately useful, et cetera. So that sell maybe was more effective as like a cultural thing, but I think it was the beginning of kind of a larger intellectual movement that we see with, seasteading, as you said, but more recently with crypto. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, Peter Thiel is kind of the ideological, you know, godfather of this crypto movement. And there's, of course, there's lots of, there's push and pull with crypto, and not everybody's kind of like the same. But I think this kind of idea of being able to like keep your money outside of state structures, kind of undermining repressive governments, like that was in the original PayPal mission, and you see it come up again and again. Now, I don't know how bought into that Peter Thiel is. I mean, I think he is. He's definitely bought into it to some extent, and he has, of course, acquired citizenship in New Zealand, which is, you know, that's like, you know, you're really living your values there in terms of exit, right? Like a lot of people, there's this idea that kind of underlies the sort of crypto PayPal libertarian thing, which is that you should be able to, as kind of a last resort, you know, be able to leave the country, and that threat is important as a way to create, put pressure on elected officials and stuff. Because like, obviously if every billionaire left, that would be bad for our tax base. So I think he buys into it to some extent, but I don't know. I mean, there's this other thread, and I don't think, you know, and that's this political and this Trumpist thread. And, I don't know how, I don't know if those are reconcilable. I mean, I think they may be just two ideas that are in competition, just like the optimistic and pessimistic portfolio, except, of course, that they both, you know, they are potentially, you know, useful for, you know, on a personal level in terms of, you know, protecting wealth and you know, and growing one's wealth, which, you know, from the Thiel, you know, point of view, like that's a really important way to build the future. I mean, like these, you know, Thiel gets attacked, right? Because he's, you know, basically out for, in some sense, like out for billionaires, right? But the response is yes, billionaires are making the future. I'm maybe oversimplifying, and you know, hopefully you'll push back. But I think there is an extent to which that's the best way to unify them.
And I think the useful thing that you're bringing here is the discussion of irreconcilability and contrasting it with the optimistic and the pessimistic portfolio. Because I think that is true. But what's so funny is, and I think Peter within his own perspective, I think finds ways to reconcile and just operate. But the funny thing, speaking of mimetic, is it's very funny to watch people who just basically try to copy Peter or take on these thoughts and arguments without having the internal ability to sort through them. So for example, and this is why I'm really pushing on the contradiction between the nationalist project and the implications of crypto, which is that if you're making this critique that the problem of American society post-1970s, and this isn't, Peter doesn't do this. People who follow Peter make this argument much more explicitly. This is the Steve Bannonite one, where right. you say these hyper-globalized, rootless cosmopolitans. And there's actually something to, like, that's like very like aggressive language, but I think there is something to that very convenient 1990s, everything's super hunky dory. We're looking at what's happening on the coast and not focused on the central part of the country. There is something to that, but using the extreme part of that rhetoric, if you were to see the conversations that people in crypto are having, if I'm a part of that nationalist project, I'm like, oh yeah, we're banning Bitcoin. Right. Oh yeah. Like we're going to be very CCP like. And just acknowledge the fact that we have open tech people saying that they are working to undermine the American project and effectively hold the government hostage through leaving with their wealth. So I just, it's so, and once again, Peter doesn't take it to the logical conclusion that MAGA does, but it's right. Just really funny to see MAGA people not understand how irreconcilable those two projects are.
Yeah. And there's never, we did see Peter, you know, a couple months ago, right? He showed up at some, I think it was a Hugh Hewitt thing, and he made a comment about Bitcoin that made some news. You know, I was watching and I wrote it up and like it blasted all over the internet because Peter Thiel said that Bitcoin might be thought of as a weapon of the Chinese government. And of course, that does not that's not great news if you're a crypto head who cares about your the like long-term value of your Bitcoin that you have in your brain vault or whatever. But I think there is that you know, it's the critique that you're bringing up right now. I mean, I think, you know, it's hard to know. It's hard to know if Peter saw Trump as a trade, you know, as just a way to you know, like this MAGA movement was, you know, insert, you know, was growing. He saw it coming, wanted to get in on it, or if he saw it as an ideological thing. I mean, I always think it's probably a bit of both. You know, I think he's somebody who is. I mean, I think this is kind of like, you know, love it or hate it. This is the brilliance, or one of the brilliant things about the guy. He's got a political project and he has a business project, and those two things are kind of operating. Sometimes they're operating in tension, but there is a relationship between them, and he's able to, you know, kind of use the business project to push, sometimes to push and feed into the political project, and also able to use the political project to sometimes feed, you know, the things he's trying to achieve, you know, from a business perspective or from a technological perspective.
Speaking of tension between business and political projects, I want to take this to the conversation about monopoly, because I think this is actually a completely fascinating time to talk about monopoly, because I think we're in this. This is just my, and I'm curious, you actually are a, you know, reporter covering like the industry. So I want to hear your take about this take before we get into Peter's writing on the subject. My concern about the conversation around tech monopolies, especially when it comes to social media companies, is that it's effectively been narratively frozen in 2014 to 2017. In the sense that you're looking at a hyper powerful Facebook, you're looking at, wow, Snapchat told we couldn't pull it off, you know, Twitter acquires Vine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I just think it's very hard to look at a space where, and once again, TikTok's not technically a social media company, but I think the broader implication of all of the tech conversation is that everything is everything. So these delineations don't make as much sense. But it's just harder and harder for me to look at Facebook in 2021 and make the conclusion that this is this huge monopoly. Because the last thing I'll put on this is, I was having this conversation with some fellow podcasters on this show, and they made the monopoly point. I said, hey, look, like Facebook is investing millions and millions of dollars in creator tools for podcasters. Is anyone on this chat going to actually use those tools? And the answer was no, but there's just four different people. By definition, yeah. If we can do that, it's not a monopoly. So just introduce monopoly in 2021 from your perspective.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's sort of like monopoly as is commonly understood by regular people, and like what, you know, market dominance or something. And then there's kind of like a sophisticated antitrust lawyer monopoly, and those are two different things. And, you know, antitrust law, you know, whatever, it's evolving, as we know. And, you know, maybe there's going to be a way to like, you know, for lawmakers, regulators to really, you know, bring the hurt on some of these big tech companies, but not clear, because they don't necessarily clearly seem like legal monopolies. I don't know. I mean, I think Facebook's dominance, you know, over our lives is very obvious. Now, you know, in terms of directing like what people, what news articles people consume, what cultural trends are on the ascent. So, I mean, I think like the talking about like, and we should talk about that dominance. You know, on the other hand, does Facebook has competitors, and those competitors are a bunch of other really, really, really big tech companies who operate very similarly. So, you know, Apple and Google and stuff. So like, I don't know. It's pretty easy, I think, for Facebook, and Facebook can make a pretty good case, right? That like, that, are you kidding me? Like, you know, where there's, you know, there are four of these other companies, and they're all as fearsome, and it, you know, but I don't know. I think the thing, I mean, what has a ring of truth for me anyway, is just the notion that these companies are controlling like a huge part of the public discourse, a huge part, not controlling, but a huge part of the discourse is happening inside of these platforms, and a huge part of the way that discourse is monetized is happening inside of those platforms. And that, to me, you know, is potentially a little bit scary. And I don't know if that means that we need to like, you know, that we need to rein them in using antitrust or something like that. But I don't know. I mean, I think the dominance is obvious. I think we could have a argument about whether it constitutes monopoly or not.
Yeah, I want to just double click on your point that the reason why these conversations get, once again, kind of contradictory and not particularly productive is there's colloquial monopoly and then there's legal monopoly. And the issue right now is that colloquially, and just like we obviously get that Facebook feels like a monopoly, and to a certain degree, if something feels like something, it is something. But on the other hand, there is this specific legal procedure in case that needs to be made here. So there's a difficulty there. Let's actually talk about the power over discourse point, because this relates to your coverage of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook's decisions around content moderation, fact-checking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I think about here is the reason we haven't come to a consensus on this discussion is that you have two basically diametrically opposed perspectives on these companies. You have the center left to left view, which is that platforms have responsibilities, they should be moderated, they should be policed, you're an editor, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yep. Then you have the right view, which is that, and I think this view is actually kind of a little more incoherent despite everything, which is that actually this is the public square, this should be a utility, you can't put your finger on the scale. Can you just talk us through how you are seeing those contradictory viewpoints clash and be sorted out?
Well, so to me, what's interesting is that there's actually some agreement between those two viewpoints. And I think that is what's so, as somebody who covers tech and has covered tech for a long time, the right, you know, as you say, like there are issues with that argument, right? And likewise, there are issues with the argument you hear on the left. But they both are arguments about power, and they're both acknowledgments that the tech companies, you know, as both sides see it, you know, but the kind of the left argument and the sort of like, you know, Ted Cruz, like Tucker or whatever argument about free speech is about power. And I do think that observation is correct, right? Like these companies have a lot of power. But it's not 100% clear how you would go about unwinding that, or whether or not unwinding that would be a good thing. I do think it's interesting that power, which is, you know, a relatively new thing that's happened. I do think that the case for that and the sort of playbook for how they got there is embedded in a lot of Peter Thiel's ideas. And you know, when he talks about in Zero to One, he talks about monopoly, right? He's not actually talking about legal monopoly. He's talking about and he makes a distinction between illegal and legal monopolies. He's talking about market dominance and this idea that in the digital age, which we see, you know, this is like the closest thing to conventional wisdom you can find now, but I think at least among like tech people. But I think it really very much originates with PayPal and Peter Thiel is this, you know, you got to, like, these things are networks and you got to control the network. You're not going to have two PayPals. You're not going to have two Facebooks. You're not going to have two Googles. You're going to have one. And that has lots of implications for how you run a business, because if you want to grow quickly, you got to do whatever it takes to get that network size. And that means from a marketing standpoint, spending huge sums of money to acquire users, which we're seeing, you know, which actually like PayPal kind of pioneered famously, brilliantly, giving people, you know, basically $10 in cash to like open a PayPal account. And we've seen, you know, variations of that, you know, these kind of, Reid Hoffman, who's a friend of Peter, has a framework called blitzscaling. It is this idea that power is the only thing that differentiates these businesses. And I think that presents problems, like, because I don't know, if the only way to build a digital business is by market dominance, that seems like it potentially creates problems for kind of our understanding of capitalism and competition. And then, you know, if you go as far as the kind of the, you know, like the guys on the right or the left, it creates problems for the public square.
It's funny. You sound very Matt Stoller-y when you're talking about power. I hear his tweets coming through my headphones, but I want to highlight the power point you're making there, because there's a shared focus on power, but if you're actually, and once again, I'm speaking more to the audience here as they're thinking about, because we've become suitably bipartisan, which is something I'm proud of, which is just the fact that the debate is actually what direction should power be positioned. I think the pushback that I'd give to left people is that their beef isn't necessarily actually that Facebook has power, quote unquote. It's that the power isn't being utilized in certain ways. So it's not, no, like, so for example, if you are, let's say, Senator Klobuchar does not actually want the Trump administration to treat Facebook like a utility. And the same thing goes on the other end of the right too, because that's where, because the utility conversation was just hinted at a bit, but I think that if there's an intellectual project or someone to engage in right now, it's actually coming up with an actionable framework for this, because as long as that's not actionable, we're stuck at a sticking point here. So something I want to talk about next, because you talk about this a lot, but I don't think I actually pertained or figured out your actual view on this question. Peter routinely, especially post 2008, goes to this, innovation is slowed down. We were promised flying cars. We got 140 characters referring to Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. Could you summarize that viewpoint? And then I'd actually just love to hear what your take on that is. Separate from the, like, is this just marketing? Just on the pure, like, intellectual argument, I'm curious what you think of it.
Yeah. So the tech slowdown, it's tech stagnation thesis says that although there has been some increase in wealth in certain areas, right? So there's, like, computers have gotten better, and we've created a lot of software jobs, and we've also had a lot of globalization, which has, you know, created a lot of jobs. I think Peter would argue that that's kind of maybe a fleeting, you know, it's a kind of like a one-time thing that might, you know, long-term do harm. We haven't seen the kind of big breakthrough innovations that we saw, you know, in the 50s and 60s, when, you know, there was, you know, like, massive government spending on tech because of the Cold War, and that there's something sort of, you know, unsatisfying, I think both economically unsatisfying, but I think for Peter, it has a moral dimension as well, maybe morally unsatisfying or something, about the companies that have thrived over the last 20 years. And, you know, there are lots of very, like, pithy arguments mm-hmm. that you can make about this. So, okay. One favorite one, which I think is it's illustrative, right? Air travel, right? The average speed of a commercial jetliner has, I think it's maybe even gone down over the last 50 years. Like, you know, the fastest, the best planes are basically no different from the planes that we were flying, you know, in the 60s and 70s, or, you know, my history of aviation, not exact, but you know what I'm saying, right?
You don't really know, but, like, if you were to actually sit a Boeing 747 from the 60s right next to a 737 Max right now and tell a layperson, explain the difference here.
Right.
They actually couldn't versus looking at a biplane and a post-World War II fighter jet. That's a huge gap.
Yeah,
difference.
And of course, you know, and we had a Concorde, right? But the Concorde was shut down because it was unviable. But one of the reasons it's unviable is because, you know, we decided as a society that we didn't want supersonic planes flying over population centers. So, like, there weren't that many routes. You know, like, it was basically killed by regulation to some extent. I think that's the view, and if we had, it takes on a political dimension, which is that if we had fewer regulations and also kind of freer thought, like, there's this idea that one of the things holding us back as a society, and especially in terms of technological development, is not just the political dimension, but that there's this oppressive culture, again, Peter's view, oppressive culture on college campuses and in, you know, research labs, probably big companies, right? That's preventing people from really, you know, questioning the norms. And we've sort of replaced technological engineering with financial engineering, something like that. It's an incredible, as you said, like, I think undeniably incredible marketing, incredible formulation. We all remember, Peter's an amazing marketer. We all remember, you know, we were promised flying cars and said, we got to hire 40 characters.
I just knew that. That wasn't a research. I knew the quote, you know?
Exactly. And that was literally like the catchphrase for Founders Fund. I mean, this is like a huge part of the marketing. Personally, I think it definitely captures truths that are real. And you know, there is something, you know, I think, you know, like I brought up the moral dimension. There is something like morally unsatisfying about that. Like the brightest, a friend of mine, Ashley Vance, wrote a story, you know, there's a quote. Mm. It's like the brightest minds of my generation are like doing ad targeting. And like, that is like a morally depressing reality. And like, I think that is part of Peter's view, but it is not complete. I do think there are responses to many of these points, and that it's less clear that the tech stagnation is real. And like, maybe I feel this way, and I think about air travel a lot because I live very close to LaGuardia Airport in Queens. And you know, personally, I am fine with the ban on the Concorde. I you know, it's not even a ban, but you know, the idea of you know, airplane noise is really bad. I like to sleep, and I think that like we may have made a reasonable compromise there. And I would also argue that the idea that air travel has not gotten better, that is a very kind of elite point of view. I recognize that air travel has not gotten better for somebody who owns a private jet. Your private jet is the same private jet as it was, but for a regular person, air travel has gotten so much better. And the idea that you would not be able to see that, to me, is kind of crazy. I mean, you can fly, you know, in the 70s, how much did a plane ticket to Europe cost? A plane ticket to Europe, you know, I don't know. We could look it up. It's, you know, it's thousands of dollars, right? And you can fly, like I've flown my whole family. I have three kids, five of us to Denmark in the summer for $2,000, you know, high season. Like, it's amazing. I mean, and not just that, but like the addition of, you know, all these routes and discount airlines and, you know, air travel has undeniably, I think, improved. It hasn't improved in this one dimension, but I'm not sure that like airspeed is the end all be all. And I think there's a tendency to, like, I would just argue that view is, it's very compelling because on the moral dimension, and it's like almost a very romantic view of technology. But like a lot of these things that are things that we actually feel, but then we kind of overlook the ways that like our lives have gotten so much better. And I don't totally understand the, I think that there are aspects of the economic critique that are certainly true, but I think it's kind of an incomplete story that also happens to be great marketing.
I'm so glad you gave the example of you personally being opposed to the Concorde, given your location in Queens, because it actually helps me think about the libertarian movement's journey that you're cataloging in this book, in the sense that what you're basically expressing is, look, I personally, and everyone who lives around you likely, through the democratic process would actually like impose a veto on that type of technological innovation. And why, and this ties us back to the conversation about why tech founders or techno-libertarians are attracted to these crypto, broader internet disruption arguments, because the basic point here is, you could vote all you want. If crypto destroys the nation state's gone. You can say, well, I don't actually like how billionaires could use this and that to leave. They're like, yeah, it doesn't really matter. Your veto doesn't actually get here. So it's just helping me realize basically, hey, not that I agree with these politics, but honestly, if you're a libertarian, there's probably much more to accomplishing your ideological goals in tech, in technological disruption, than engaging the democratic process, which gets to the tension that political libertarians have with that actual system.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this is, Thiel kind of expressed this to some extent in that kind of famous or slash infamous Cato essay that he wrote, you know, where he talks about, you know, it's called The Evolution of a Libertarian. I'm sure some people are familiar with it, but, you know, he talks about sort of being skeptical of democracy. And I think that's kind of the beginning of him breaking with or something with more conventional kind of libertarian things, where he talks about that instead of you know, engaging politically, he's going to engage, you know, technologically. And that includes, you know, that issue was edited by the Seasted guy, Patrick Friedman, who is, you know, a friend of Peter's, has, you know, taken his money, you know, Peter funded Seasteading. But of course it goes into,
and by the way, you didn't, I don't think you mentioned this book. He's Milton Friedman's grandson.
Yeah, no, it's mentioned.
Oh, yeah. It's a key detail.
Of course. I think Peter's very good at combining kind of like this ideology, like an ideological aspect with kind of packaging. And of course, like Seasteading being founded by, you know, Milton Friedman's grandson is, you know, like, that's really cool. I think undeniably. And so anyway, I think that these things are all, he talked also about, you know, funding space companies, you know, right? Like all these ways to kind of go beyond politics.
And I want to put aside the Thiel Fellow part of the conversation, because I'm interested in how you think the higher education bubble argument has advanced, because this is also another good example of what does an actual bubble at a financial level mean, and what does a bubble in the colloquial sense mean? Because you're just really seeing, at least rhetorically and actually empirically, the higher education system didn't blow up over that 10-year period. And I don't think you could, like, I think if COVID showed one thing, it's that actually, like, the society we live in is set up to preserve the system of higher education as it exists. At the same time, though, that preservation, like the fact that colleges were able to charge the same price relative to how diminished the offering was, advances Peter's argument in a different direction, which is his point, and I wrote this down when this was in the book, that at a core level, his critique of the higher education system is that it's ultimately a class signaling credential that isn't actually about substantive points. So can you talk to the bubble bursting part, but then also to like the credentialing aspect?
Yeah. And like you said, I mean, I think that the Thiel Fellowship, it exists on a couple of different levels, but one is as a critique, as a way to say, you know, it's a very ambitious critique, right? Because there's a much easier argument Peter could have made, which is that, like, there are all these crappy for-profit, the kind of more conventional argument, right? There are all these crappy for-profit colleges. There are all these, like, private colleges that really cost a fortune and don't do anything for their graduates beyond sort of put them in debt. And they're really successful at, you know, so, like, that's, like, a more, I'd say, like, a more expected critique, probably an easier, I think it's like an easier sell, right? But instead he went after Harvard and said, you know, I'm not going to just make the argument that college sucks. I'm not going to make the argument that Harvard sucks even. I'm going to make the argument that Harvard sucks for the most brilliant people, that even the most brilliant minds, you know, don't need Harvard and can't get anything out of it. And I think that is like a really bold and ambitious argument. And I think it is in some ways, it gets at obviously some real truth. I do wonder, you know, whether or not that is, I don't know. Like it to me, being one of the most brilliant people probably means you need Harvard a little bit less. Probably means you need college a little bit less. And we've certainly seen, you know, lots and lots of, you know, brilliant young people, you know, find alternate paths to kind of like, to starting like really innovative companies. There are like a handful of Thiel Fellows who, you know, are just like absurdly young and absurdly successful. This guy behind this company, Luminar, which is like a LIDAR company, you know, I forget. He's like runs a public company now and he's like 24, you know, something like that. And so like that is, I mean, that is undeniable. I think there has been, and I think it's certainly like had a huge impact in the way sort of technologists think about credentials. I'm not sure how broad that impact has been, whether it has had been very successful. I mean, and certainly had an impact like for Peter Thiel and his ability to like, you know, people like being right about something is, you know, that will get you followers and stuff. So I think it's had an impact there. I'm not sure it's really had much of an impact in terms of like as an attack, as a real attack on the system. I mean, he definitely was right. He definitely was ahead of the curve. But as you say, the system pretty much persists.
And the interesting thing here is I was going to kind of unfairly dunk and point out, and the crazy thing is, Everyone in this story all went to Stanford together in the 80s and 90s. So what does that tell you? But at the same time, you actually get at this towards the end of the book when you point out a challenge for Peter is at a core level, what he successfully was able to do was with the Stanford Review, with the PayPal Mafia, he was able to bring together these networks at a very direct in-person level. And what you're seeing with the internet, at least hypothetically, this hasn't truly been proven out at a scalable level yet, because because what's interesting is like, even in cases where, because I have all these like technical libertarian friends in my age cohort who are like, yeah, like the internet proves that all these networks are dead, but it's like, but wait, like you guys were all still connected through this person who met his founding partner at Stanford. So Stanford still gets credit for that bit there. The interesting debate over the next 20 years is there going to be a Stripe mafia? Or is there going to be a Twitter DM mafia that was completely unattached and found itself purely through merit? And that's something which there's no actual indication of this either direction. But I think that's a very much like people should put a pin in that and think about that network thing.
Yeah. And but I think we also should like expect elite institutions to respond, right? Like, you know, Harvard or Stanford, you know, wants to claim credit for these mafias as well, and will do things and will create, you know, we'll try to find ways, right, to attach themselves to these networks, and probably will succeed because, like, yeah, I mean, there's still, you know, tons of brand value, to use such a crass term about college. But yeah, I mean, I think there's like a, it's true that this is happening. Of course, it's not going to happen in a vacuum. And like these institutions remain very powerful, you know, the allure of, a Stanford professorship or to teach a class at Stanford as Peter has done several times, right? Like that's going to create ways for these institutions to continue and to exercise their power. I mean, they're not going to stand still either.
Actually, I'm going to jump back to the monopoly point because you had this interesting line that I wanted to hear a little more expanded, which is that you said that Peter wasn't particularly happy with the reception of Zero to One, which to note, like 3 million copies. Derek Thompson, I think this is Derek Thompson. This is a funny review, like Apex Airport book, right? It's a great. I read it. I literally read it on a plane. It's a great airport book. But you said that people misinterpret it from Peter's perspective. They misinterpreted the monopoly point, what he was trying to say.
So I think he's kind of like, I think this is another one of these two minds thing, right? Like, I don't think I think he does believe, right, that network effects necessitate that companies grow really big. I think he was trying to be more provocative. And I think, you know, I would be cautious if I were talking to Peter Thiel face to face to tell him, hey, you wrote the best airport book that's ever been written, right? That is, you know, that's praise, but it's praise of a kind. And I think Peter Thiel has, you know, greater ambitions than to, you know, to write a best-selling business book, right? There's a philosophic work buried in Zero to One. And so I think he was, and as I read in the book, you know, he was putting forward a theory of business success. He was also undoing what I think in retrospect is a pretty unsubtle attack against Google, you know, and calling Google a monopoly, not an illegal monopoly, but having this kind of market dominance that was underappreciated. And you see that argument, you know, again and again in public. You know, he's has, you know, a debate with Eric Schmidt, where Eric Schmidt being the, you know, the former CEO, executive chairman of Google, where Eric Schmidt is kind of putting forward this very kind of rosy kind of version of a response to the tech stagnation thesis. You know, it's kind of like a lot of this doesn't stand up that well in retrospect, but you know, these Egyptians are using their smartphones to, you know, have a revolution or whatever. And Thiel, you know, just, you know, kind of puts them down pretty severely by calling Google, you know, a monopoly and basically saying, you guys aren't creating any value. You're just kind of, and so I do think there's a tendency, there was an effort to be provocative there that kind of got missed, but partly because it worked as a playbook. And instead of being read as, you know, Peter Thiel has, you know, one of the like founding members of Silicon Valley, the guy who created, I would argue, right, more than any other person has created Silicon Valley as it exists today, is calling the Valley's most iconic company a monopoly. Like that to me should have been a big controversy. And I think Peter probably wanted it to be a big controversy because he likes controversy, likes being provocative. And instead it was just sort of like, and you can too, you know? And I think that, that had a huge impact. But I'm not sure it was 100% the impact that was intended.
Yeah. So I've got two last bits here. The first of which is going back to your point about him pushing back on Eric Schmidt's social media triumphalism about the Arab Spring. This is just why, once again, I'm not trying to just overpraise Peter, but there just are these very specific cases, especially at that narrative level, where he's making a point that 3 or 4 years later is just conventional wisdom, right? So it is just now widely agreed that the whole the existence of Twitter is going to upend authoritarianism and and basically kind of to Peter's point, it was ahistorical. It didn't actually bear out in the facts and it wasn't as truly disruptive. That's all conventional wisdom. And the conventional wisdom too around, so once again, the point he's making around copycats and everything with the, you know, Rene Girard thought, like, if you just read a conventional tech take, it's that, yeah, there were way too many Uber for X companies in 2015. So that's just why I think no matter what, he needs to be taken seriously, because at a broad, taking a step back level, it seems like he's been correct about those points.
100%. Yeah, 100% agree with you. And I really think, like, you know, obviously this book, or maybe not obviously, but, you know, this book is critical of Peter Thiel in lots of ways. But I also think that he is worthy, as you say, of respect. And that respect partly has to do with, I think it's important that we understand, you know, the people who run the world, you know, I want to know what they think. But also because you're right, he's been right. You know, there's this amazing put down from Jeff Bezos where he says, you know, I think it was around when Peter was unmasked as the guy behind Gawker, or maybe it was about Trump, I can't remember. But Jeff Bezos said, you know, the thing about contrarians is they're usually wrong. And okay, so there's some truth to that. But I also think it's not that Peter has been wrong all the time. A lot of the time his insights, as you say, are right. And like, that's why they are so attractive, not just attractive, you know, from a business standpoint, but attractive, like from an intellectual standpoint. And I think and he hasn't always been right, I would argue, in the execution of some of those ideas. And I also think there is something very attractive, right, about the honesty. Peter Thiel has a tendency to kind of say, like, that line about monopoly, saying that, you know, actually these tech businesses are all about power. Like, that's a contrarian observation, but it's also is true, right? It has this ring of truth, and I think that is, you know, very attractive and also you know, worthy of respect.
Yeah. So the last quick thing here, I would like to hear your thought on, which is another way of looking at that impulse thing, is you could look at the story of Palantir and the entanglement with the US government, and you're saying, hey, like, it's kind of hypocritical, he's a libertarian, this or that. But the thing that's interesting for me there is that in many ways that just anticipated the way the 2020s are really coming down to this big tech standoff between the US and China, and companies having to make choices about how they're going to be defined, how they're going to basically operate. So I'm just curious how you think about that in our closing, as we're looking at the more future facing part of that. I think of all of the, like, what's a conversation that's fun for 2015, but what's something that matters today? It's the leaning into companies aligned at the US government part that matters.
I think that clearly, you know, one of the premises of this kind of Silicon Valley movement that Peter was initially a part of and has kind of turned critic of, was this kind of like Beyond Borders thing, which has, you know, it doesn't look as good right now, right? It's you know, it especially, you know, as tension has heated up with China, as the Chinese government has moved, you know, really aggressively to clamp down on free speech, and to sort of this kind of more muscular vision of sort of Chinese power, particularly tech power, like it just doesn't look that good, that ideology. I also, though, I mean, you know, I also think it happens to be a very useful sort of talking point for Facebook and for a lot of these big tech companies, because so it's hard to untangle. I do think that it contains a lot of truth, but it's also like it's like Mark Zuckerberg's number one point in the reason why the U.S. government should ban TikTok and or not just TikTok, sorry, not ban TikTok, right? But not regulate Facebook. We gotta let Facebook, you know, mine whatever data it wants to mine. I'm, you know, paraphrasing and maybe being a little bit crass about it, but we have to do that because TikTok, which is, you know, as he argues, you know, an arm of the CCP, is doing that already. So either we do it or they're going to do it for us. And I mean, you know, like I accept that argument. I think it's a powerful argument. I think it's a little bit scary. I think it comes pretty close to saying the Chinese are so bad that we need to be like them. And I don't know. I don't quite know how to think about that. And it's and you see that not just from the kind of Peter Thiel aligned tech folks, but also Eric Schmidt, who is on the other side of the of Peter Thiel on so many issues, but has made, you know, very similar arguments, this kind of nationalistic case for a lack of regulation that kind of comes down to, you know, we want to be more like China. And I don't know. Again, it just sort of makes me uncomfortable as somebody who believes in, you know, free speech and democracy and kind of, you know, whatever the U.S. as kind of commonly imagined.
That's the perfect place to leave, because what you just said around all of that gets to my basic editorial takeaway from the book, which is take his diagnoses very seriously. There is like this truth that, once again, companies are having to make choices, but we should debate the implications and actions that one takes with the actual insight there.
Thanks. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that's a great summary.
Well, Max, obviously, people need to check out The Contrarian. I could tell you, we have a bookshop that moves a decent amount of copies. We sold a bunch of books before you even came on the show. We're recording this week before it comes out. So, you know, lots of really great stuff there, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Marshall. And thanks so much for engaging. You know, like, love the questions, and just love, you know, coming at this from an angle that I haven't heard before. So, you know, really appreciate the time and thought.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.